Tweet at Today SOR.
At the conclusion of Kitty Yates' new book, The Maths of Life and Death, the author describes maths as a current running almost unseen beneath the surface of our affairs. Kitty Yates is a mathematical biologist and faculty member in the University of Bath, and he joins me now from the UK. Thank you indeed for joining us, Kit. There are some people who just can't hack maths at all, and I might be in that club myself. Now, were you aware of this when you set about writing this book?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, yeah, it's a big thing, maths. People have a fear of maths sometimes. And what I'm not advocating in the book is that everyone should go and do degree level maths. But what I am trying to say is that people can get some of the maths concepts that are in the book that might be important and use those in their everyday life. But yeah, deliberately, I've written it with non-mathematicians in mind. So there's no equations in the book. This is not a maths book. It's not a book for mathematicians. It's a book for everyday man, you and me, who want to know a bit more about the places where maths can appear in their everyday life.
Now, in the early pages, you talk about exponential growth and nuclear energy. You argue that nuclear energy suffers from a poor reputation. Why so, and what's your own opinion?
Well, I think there's been a number of high-profile nuclear disasters, Chernobyl being the big one that features in the book with massive environmental impact. But actually, since then, nuclear energy's been pretty safe, and it's also a relatively low-carbon form of energy. So, in general, I'm a proponent of nuclear energy, but there's a whole minefield behind that. So, yeah, it's a big one to get into.
You've got some really fascinating insights into how adults and children perceive time. You even argue that we could effectively make our lives last longer.
Yeah, to some degree, or at least seem to last longer. So our perception of time can be thought of as being exponential. Perhaps if you believe this theory, that we perceive a passage of time as a proportion of the time we've already lived through. So for my four-year-old son, the time between his birthdays a year is a quarter of his life. So it seems eternally long to wait. I don't know if you remember how long the school holidays seem to last when you were a kid. But when you get older, so I'm 34 now, so a year is roughly 3% of my life. Birthdays seem to come around at a sort of terrifying pace. So, there's this idea that time our perception of time is increasing exponentially. So the time period between the ages of 5 and 10 could feel just as long as the ages between 40 and 80. So, yeah, make the most of it.
Indeed. Now, speaking of your four-year-old, tell me about, and this is really fascinating, how you helped him to do a calculation on how many creepy crawlies or snails was it that you had in your garden?
Yeah. Yeah, he loves creepy crawlies, spiders, bugs, whatever. So we're always out in the garden, and he'd gathered a few together. And he said, Daddy, how many snails are there in the garden? And, I didn't really know how to answer this. But then I remembered this this mathematical technique called capture-recapture. So we went out and we collected a sample of snails from around the garden, and we put a cross on the back of their shells, so nothing damaging to them, just with a pen. And then we put them all back in the garden, and we waited for a week. And then we went out and collected another batch of snails, and we counted how many of the ones that we caught in this second sample had the cross on their back that we'd marked from before. And the idea is that the proportion of snails in that second capture, in fact it was a sixth of the snails that we captured, should be the same as the proportion of the snails we captured in the first capture to the total number of snails in the garden. So we could use that figure we worked out from the second capture, 1/6, to scale up the number we caught in the first capture by a factor of 6 and calculate roughly how many snails there are in the garden. So this isn't just a toy. I mean, you can do this on your own on the weekend if you want to, but people use this in real life situations to estimate the number of war dead in conflict zones where you can't actually count all the bodies, or to estimate the number of drug addicts in the United States, for example. So it has real practical applications too.
Which brings us to medicine now. You make an interesting point about medical tests, namely screenings, and how the illusion of certainty for patients can be misleading.
Yeah, so there's two sides to this, I think. One thing that a lot of people don't know is that if you have a disease which has a low prevalence in a population, so for example, breast cancer in the United Kingdom, undiagnosed breast cancer has a prevalence of just 0.4%, so around 4 in 1,000 women will have breast cancer. If you go for a screen which has what's called a low specificity, i.e. you'll get some false positives, then because so many women are being tested that don't have the disease, of all the women that get given a positive result, result, the vast majority of them actually won't have the disease. So this is something that everyone should be aware of when they go for screening tests, that if you get a false positive, it doesn't necessarily mean that you've got the disease. I think you should view it in analogy to an interview. Just because you're getting invited for an interview for a job, you wouldn't have thought you've got the job. And for the same reason, if you get invited for follow-up tests in a screen, you wouldn't assume you've got the disease.
No, just explain this a bit more, because what you say is, if your mammogram comes back positive, the overwhelming likelihood is that you don't have breast cancer.
Yeah, exactly. If you're negative for breast cancer, 9 times out of 10 the test will correctly tell you that, but 1 time out of 10 it won't. And because the vast majority of women who are being screened don't have breast cancer, so 99.6% won't actually have breast cancer, that 10% adds up to a large number of women, much larger than the 0.4% of women who go for a test and actually do have breast cancer. So of all the people that get given a positive result, the vast majority of those will be false positives. So there'll be people who get told they have to come for further testing, but actually don't have the disease. And this can cause, you know, huge psychological distress to a lot of people. People hear the C word and they start planning for the worst case, but actually when they go for the follow-up tests, the majority of the time it turns out that they don't actually have the disease. So yeah, it's something that's quite alarming and not many people know about. The other thing to be aware of is if you do this test, which has this low specificity, the chance of false positives, if you go for 7, 8 or 9 screens, which is sort of likely over the course of a woman's lifetime, you should start to expect a false positive. It becomes more likely than not that you'll receive a false positive over the course of your lifetime. So being aware of this, and being aware that if you get a false positive or a positive screening result, you shouldn't be alarmed, because the likelihood is it's a false positive is quite important. What I'm not advocating, though, is not going to screening. Like, screening can be important diagnostic tool, but what I am saying is take the results with a pinch of salt. And also be aware of this thing that you mentioned, the illusion of certainty. The people who are dealing with statistics and numbers in our everyday lives, so the doctors, the expert witnesses in the law court, the newspapers, they're not always the best people to tell us these statistics. They don't always have the best grip on it.
You say we should be wary of statistics, in fact, be they in ads, maybe especially in ads or in the news.
Sure.
Why is that? And you highlight one by a claim by L'Oreal, I think, for a skin product.
Yeah, I guess the important thing to remember is that newspapers and adverts obviously have a hidden agenda. Statistics, I think people view numbers as being these hard pieces of independent truth, but you can always spin a statistics. There's a famous book called How to Lie with Statistics, and obviously there's this famous quote, damn lies and statistics. It's really important to be aware that people who are who are using figures don't always have your best interest at heart. L'Oreal did a survey a number of years ago for a specific product, which they then put on an advert, but the survey size was incredibly, incredibly small, and so they potentially cherry-picked the results to display that their product was better than perhaps it actually was.
Yeah, and just one other thing, I mean, you write a lot about algorithms as well. That's an algorithm, of course, a process or a set of rules to be followed in calculations or other problem-solving operations, especially by computer. Now, you say we should use algorithmic thinking when picking what restaurant to visit.
Yeah, there's a nice little trick that I try to give people in the book. It's called optimal stopping problem. So you can use it in all sorts of areas. People have even tried to use it to choose the best life partner. The idea is that if you're going to go out to a restaurant and you think you might have a chance to look over 10 restaurants, after that, maybe whoever you're with is going to get a bit bored of looking at restaurants. You need to have a strategy to decide how you're going to choose one. So you should look through a few, and then you should just judge them for quality, because otherwise you don't know what's out there. But you don't want to look through all of them, because otherwise you'll have got to the end and you won't be able to go back to the first ones. So the idea is that you should look through the first 37% of options, judge them for their quality, and then choose the next one that you come to, which is the next best after that. You can use it for choosing the best queue at the supermarket. Again, skip through the first 37% and then choose the shortest one after that, or even getting the best seat on the train. So look at the first 37% of the carriages and choose the best one that's most empty after that.
Okay, well, look, it's fascinating stuff. I should say, by the way, I don't think we can take results of screening with a pinch of salt. As you did say, these tests are an important tool. But in any event, we leave it there. Kit Yates, thank you so much indeed for joining us. The Maths of Life and Death, Why Maths is Almost Everything.